Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for attending. And now, without further ado, to answer your questions, we welcome Commissioner Carl Benson.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for attending today's press conference. At a time when there are so many uncertainties facing intercollegiate athletics, I thought that this would be a good opportunity to address some of those issues. Who's got the first question?
I got a question. Trent Krim from The Independent.
Really? Trent Krim from The Independent? Are you kidding me? What's your question?
Well, what makes you qualified to be a commissioner?
And alive. That's the best that you can have at a time when we've got all these issues facing us, and that's the best question you have? That's the stupidest question I've ever heard. And really, who let this guy in?
For diehard and casual college basketball fans, it's the very best time of the year. March Madness is arriving for a school near you, and it won't be long until we all have our brackets printed out and we're ready to start being fans of teams we don't normally care about. But what is it like for folks on the NCAA Basketball Tournament Selection Committee? They're tasked with setting up those brackets, making sure the best and most deserving 69 teams get their chance to go to the big dance. For them, it's been months of hard work. This week on Knutson and the Commish, Carl talks about what it's like to be on the selection committee. He served a five-year term on the committee 2 decades ago. Some things have changed and others haven't. We get Carl's takes on what goes into setting up those brackets we're all eager to see on this week's episode. It's next, right here on Knutson and the Commish. Stay with us.
For the best selection of autographs and memorabilia from your favorite sports stars past and present, look no further than DenverAutographs.com. Find what you're after on the web or at either of their two Metro Denver locations, Colorado Mills Mall and Flatirons Mall, Broncos, Rockies, Avs, Nuggets, and much more. It's all at DenverAutographs.com.
Learning life skills through baseball, USA Prime is more than just travel baseball. We mentor young athletes in areas like teamwork and skill development. It's about more than winning weekend tournaments. It's about showing young players how to achieve their goals in baseball and beyond. Contact Scott Horman at usaprimecolorado@gmail.com for more information.
If you are a college basketball fan, this is the most wonderful time of the year. This is the time everybody looks for. In fact, people who aren't college basketball fans become college basketball fans when the calendar turns to March. And March Madness is right around the corner, Carl. It is an awesome time of year. You've described it as the best postseason in all of sports. You could very well be right about that. Certainly when it comes to engagement with people who aren't necessarily fans of the sport itself, this is the time for office pools and so on and so forth. Everybody's got their brackets out. But let's start out by talking about what leads up to Selection Sunday before the brackets come out. How things are kind of whittling down now to that final 68 teams now. It's a process. As you as a committee member, and you were a committee member for a long time, this is not just something you show up on Sunday and start doing. You guys have a lot of prep going into this.
Absolutely, Mark. And before I go there, I'll tell you that my daughter, who experienced all these Final Fours during her time and hasn't missed one since 2002 or three, I believe, she's also a big college football fan. She calls the bowl season the most wonderful time of the year, but she calls March Madness the happiest time of the year. Huh. So this is her now. She's approaching her happy time.
But it's work time for the people. On the committee, it's work time, right?
It is, and it's a big time consumption that committee members are either athletic directors, current athletic directors, or current commissioners. There are no coaches on this committee. Right. It's one of the few sport committees where there are no coaches because it's right in the heart of their season.
And no retired people like, former commissioners. So you have to be active in the game.
You have to be active in your jobs, in your employment. And usually the proportionate is 7 or 8 athletic directors and, 2 or 3 commissioners, at any one time. And again, my time on the committee was 2002, 3, 4, and 5, and 6. I had a 5-year term. It was the first group of committee members that went from a 4-year term to a 5-year term. And they joked that the reason that it went to a 5-year term was because Benson, being a non-basketball person, needed that one extra year to really get up to speed on the sport of basketball. So I was in the first class of 5-year committee people, but it starts 1st of November when the first polls come out and we're instructed to kind of do our own preseason poll. Mm-hmm. And again, this goes back 20 years now. it's changed a little bit in terms of how dependent you might be on polls and some of the various rankings. But right. still, I think you had to get a benchmark at the beginning of the season as to, you know, who should we really look at? So that process started back in, you know, in November, and, you know, regular season games would start around Thanksgiving, and, you know, and we're all trying to do our day jobs.
Yeah.
And that being in the middle of the football season. Yep. But when it really kicked in was about January 15th, you know, back in those days, you know, you depended on Dish or DirecTV for your television opportunities. There was very little streaming, and yep. committee members would be issued a subscription to both Dish TV or DirecTV. And sometimes you'd have both satellites on your house so that you could maximize the number of games that you're able to watch. Today with ESPN Plus and the fact that, you know, that there isn't a game that you can't watch.
Yeah. And record and watch. Yeah. At some other point. Yeah.
And record and watch for sure. So, you know, and me not being a basketball, you know, junkie, so to speak, you know, I probably evaluated different than other committee members who maybe had coached or had played. And, you know, I kind of set some of my own rules in terms of what was important to me. And that was the beauty of the committee too, was that we came from different sectors.
Yes.
And there were a lot of debates. Today, there is so much analytics involved and so much yeah. data versus when we had it, but we still had our own, you know, we still had our own system, so to speak, to evaluate. And I always had one, you know, that was, I think it still holds to today, is who did you play? Where was the game played? And did you win or lose the game? And, you know, and that I didn't take into account whether, you know, one of the players was injured right. or a coach was out or what type of style, you know, if the team was playing a slowdown opponent. Right. I just kind of took that as my holy grail, so to speak.
And now tell me who you were watching, because there are conferences, Colonial and all those, who are one bid leagues. They're going to be one bid leagues, right? And you don't necessarily have to watch their regular season because whoever wins their tournament is going to be in. They're not somebody you're looking at large. But on the other hand, you are looking to see how good they are in relation to where they might be seated, because all conference champions are not seated alike. How many games, who were you watching? Were you watching the small schools? Yep. Were you watching the middle of the Big Ten and the Pac-12 and the Big 12 and all that? Or were you watching the little guys too?
Yeah, each committee member, and it still occurs today, and it happened, you know, the CFP selection process was really derived from the NCAA basketball yeah. process. Bill yeah. Hancock having been with the NCAA basketball. So a lot of the same policies and procedures that the football guys are using, the basketball guys used. And one of those was a conference monitoring program. Each committee member was given, you know, three conferences to be their primary person that really dove into those three conferences and knew everything about those conferences.
Okay.
At the same time, you know, getting a broader look at, you know, at the rest of the field. You know, Mark, I always thought that my time on the committee, and it was just self-delegated, so to speak, is that I was always watching for the little guys. And, okay. you know, I was the commissioner of the WAC during that time. And the WAC was one of the, you know, the premier, you know,
yes.
football conferences, but it also had some, you know, some really good basketball yeah. history.
Yep.
But I had a lot of friends and colleagues who were commissioners of the Horizon League or the Big West or the Big Sky Conference and, you know, the Colonial.
Right.
And when George Mason or Butler or Virginia Commonwealth, you know, was you know, advancing in the tournament and getting to the Final Four, you know, I enjoyed that because I felt like I was always an advocate and an ambassador for, you know, for those teams from, you know, the label, the mid-major yeah. label that pretty much incorporated everybody except for the, you know, the five or six power conferences.
So now we're into conference tournament week, right? As we're doing right now. When you're in conference tournament week, did you have like a list of 80 teams or however many teams that you say, okay, these are the guys, and then you're eliminating people and you're going in there on Sunday with your 69 or your 64 at the time?
First of all, one of the downsides of being on the committee is that, you don't get to attend your own, your own conference tournament. If you're an athletic director and you have a team that, that is a pretty good basketball team, you're not there, to watch them cut down the nets of the Big Ten, or, in the time that I was a commissioner, we had some pretty decent teams in the WAC at the time. And I was not able to go to those conference tournaments. So we arrived in Indianapolis, on Monday or Tuesday, and we would start preparing. And one of the first things that you did when we got there was to turn in a sheet. And back in these days, it was not automated as it is today in terms of the data collection. We did a hard copy of 90 teams.
90. Okay. 90, that's the number.
90 teams.
Wow.
That regardless of whether they are automatic, qualifiers or not. And so we kind of started with that and then used that as our, and I think from that 90 list, though, I think the NCAA staff would put together if a team got more than one vote, if a team got, myself and another, then it would go to the to be considered pool of teams.
Okay.
And so the very first time that we would sit around the table, it now might have been whittled down to, to 65 teams or so. And, then it was a matter of, tournament games started coming on and you got, in this case, when the committee goes to Indianapolis this week, or they're already there, there's already a half a dozen automatic qualifiers.
Right, right. Some teams are already.
So those would already go up on the board and you would do some preliminary, whether a conference, even though they had their automatic, is there an at-large team? Is there a team in the Big South Conference or the Atlantic Sun or, any of the above? That really deserves, any at-large consideration. Good example, last night, the West Coast Conference.
Yes.
This was 20 years ago when Gonzaga was just getting started.
Right.
And that would always be a conference that, do they get a second team?
Yes.
Gonzaga, do they get a second team?
And now they've got St. Mary's and BYU and some other teams out there that need consideration. Okay, so you go in with your list, but then obviously there's those inevitable conference tournament upsets where some team that's not even in your 90 ends up running the table and getting into their turn and winning their tournament. And that, who does that throw out? Does that throw out a Power Five team? Does that throw out their conference champion? You got to make some hard decisions at that point.
Well, and those conferences generally are the one bid leagues and you really, you're not going to, they didn't steal a team. They didn't steal a spot. And again, they're still going to be a handful of, if they don't win their tournament, are they to be considered? And so you would start that. There was also a pretty unique part. You mentioned seeding. I always thought that the most difficult part wasn't the selection. It was the seeding. And then also, there's going to be 32 automatics.
Right.
And then now today was 68. You've got 36 at larges,
right.
and that's where it really, really kind of gets down to evaluating one team over another. And, we the same arguments that happened today. Is it the name of the school on the front of your jersey, or is it the players? There's still, unfortunately, this belief that the power. The Power Five, Power Six, Power Seven conferences, are going to get greater consideration.
Right.
And that, a team from, the SEC or the AC, back in those days, it was the ACC and the Big 12 and the Big 10, were probably the most dominant conference. The SEC at that time was
Kentucky.
It was a one or two or three teams at best. Yeah. But, and again, I always wanted to make sure that a team, that got beat in their tournament. And the example that I use, Mark, is Butler in 2002 had just kind of come on the scene and they got beat in their tournament the week before the committee started. Mm-hmm. So they had that early tournament. So Butler is sitting there 28-1. Yeah. Their only loss was in their tournament and they're on the at-large board. And, and I'm trying to make the argument Is it the most deserving team, or is it the best team?
Lifetime argument, yeah.
It is, and it, you know, it falls over into, you know, into, you know, into the football selection today. And I was a strong advocate that, you know, that it's the most deserving team, because if you just put five players from Duke against five players from Butler, and try to say who was the best team, you know, Duke's going to win that argument every time.
Well, and almost one year they almost didn't, remember?
No, that's true. Gordon Hayward, that's true. Yeah. But in 2002, the example I was going to use is that Missouri had a very, very good team in 2002. They were preseason top five. Even in early December, they were ranked as high as number two. They may have had some injuries, but they got into conference play. They finished 9-7 in the Big 12 tournament. They ended up, you know, getting to the championship game. They were up against Butler for the very last spot, the very last spot. And again, I took my set of principles and said that, you know, here is a team, Butler, that did everything they expected it to. And here you have a team like Missouri that underperformed, lost games that they should have won. And we're sitting here debating who is the most deserving team versus who is the best.
Right.
I lost that argument, and Butler got left out.
Wow.
Missouri was the last team in, and they ended up being a number 12 seed. Now, they were a team that got hot at the end. They enter the tournament as a number 12 seed. They're not really a 12 seed, talent-wise.
Right.
But as the last team in, you know, they're going to be a number 12. So they beat number 5 in the proverbial 12
beating 5. Yep.
Yeah. They win the next game. They advance to the Sweet 16 as a number 12 seed. They are playing the number 1 seed, UCLA, and they beat UCLA. And in my opinion, that was really unfair to the teams that they had to play, because Missouri had no business being a number 12 seed. So anyway, that's an example that I, you know, that 20 years later here today, I still would argue that in that case, you know, Missouri didn't deserve to get in.
How about this situation? I don't know. 6-7 years ago, Larry Eustace had a Colorado State team that was 27-3, got knocked out by Wyoming in the first round of the Mountain West tournament. Wyoming went on and ran the table, won the conference tournament. Colorado State got left out with a 27-3 record. So that's a conference that has multiple bids. It's not a one-bid conference. I think Wyoming was one of three Mountain West teams that got in. But Wyoming essentially stole CSU's bid. They beat them on the court, and but they stole the bid. Going into this year, going into this Mountain West tournament, starts out, the Mountain West is considered a four-bid league right now by most people. Colorado State's ranked 23rd. Wyoming is ranked, is right on the right in there too. But if a UNLV, for instance, wins that conference tournament, does the Mountain West still get five teams in then, or does somebody who lost earlier in the year, a Boise State regular season champion, a San Diego State, a Wyoming or CSU, does somebody get left out?
Well, this is one of the things that they try to tell the public and tell the media, that they don't look at conference affiliation.
Right.
I have a hard time sometimes accepting that.
Yep.
And, you know, do they have kind of a limit on how many teams one conference gets over another? But in this case, you know, they'll say that it won't make any difference, and that they'll look at all these teams independent of what conference they're in. And if they, you know, if they're a deserving team, or if they are the statement from the committee chairman, we determined that they were one of the best 36 teams in the country, thus they got in, versus they weren't one of those top 36, because remember, it's those 36 at-larges that become the pivotal point. One of the things, and I'm assuming that they still have too, that is used, there was always a subcommittee of the committee that was delegated to look at the last four lines, the 13, 14, 15, 16 seed, trying to make sure that teams were just automatically slotted in the number 16, kind of the label of being a 16 seed. There was also, this was in the early days of the play-in games, and generally the two 16 team, you know, we had to go to and play in the play-in before it expanded, you know, from you know, at that time it was the 65. There were 65 teams. And so, unfortunately, you know, one or two of the historically black conferences, either the SWAC or the MEAC, you know, were perennially getting in those playing games. And it created some sensitivity, and it created a kind of a sense of urgency to kind of spread that those 16 seeds around, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you hate to say that it was jerry-rigged, but you know, all you had to do is go back in history and look mm-hmm. at if a team was a 16 seed, you know, once or twice in a row, you know, they're not going to be 16 on the third year. So they'll get
placed there. And now they've got a different where the play-in games, there's four play-in games now, right? But they're not always feeding into the 16 seed. Sometimes they're feeding into the 13. Some are feeding, and they're all different in all four quadrants. Some will feed into the 12 seed game. How do they determine where that play-in game fits into the larger picture of the bracket?
Well, I think the example that I gave with Missouri the year that they were the last team in,
right,
they would have been in this play-in game.
Yes.
And I really like what they've structured there, because the games that are being played in Dayton are no longer
all 16s. Yeah.
16s.
Right.
And I know that the TV networks really have adopted and embraced that, because those are games that are watched and meaningful games, and the ratings are better for those play-in games.
Yeah.
And they've tried to eliminate that term play-in to, you know, first four, which I think is, you know, is okay. I don't know if it's been adopted by the rest of the world. You know, it's funny because those first four games still aren't part of the bracket challenges.
Yeah, right.
And until they're part of the bracket challenges, then I think the general public still looks at them, or you're still going to look at them and play the games.
But I just think that's fascinating. That, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but I believe what they go into, whether it's computerized or whatever, or however you guys come up with it, they rank them 1 through 69, right? They have and then they base the seedings off those 1 through 69. So the first 1, 2, 3, 4 are the number one seeds in the various quadrants. Is that accurate? And then if they have two teams that are tied for 47th, they are a play-in game. Is that how they do it?
That is correct. It's called an S curve is what they've created. Then, you know, and it goes, you know, kind of left to right and come back and all the seed lines. And, you know, historically, they would never identify who that number, who was really the true number one seed. But they've done that now in recent years. So that's created, you know, I think even some more controversy, because a lot of times there was not a lot of difference between one of the one seeds and, you know, the next two mm-hmm. seed.
Yeah.
And now that S curve is identified. And I know there are many times when, you know, and I would, you know, or a committee member would have to call an athletic director or a pissed off coach trying to explain, you know, why they were a five seed and not a four seed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what that meant. I remember one particularly, and this was in the early days of Gonzaga, and it also impacts Wyoming here, that we talked about, that Gonzaga was expecting to be a top four seed, and they had, you know, they'd already kind of been established as a legitimate, you know, NCAA team, and they had a good season, and they didn't make the top four. They got number five. Mark Few was pretty unhappy, and he had been unhappy before, and it was one of the conferences that, you know, that I'd been selected to monitor, and I knew Mark, and so I called him on Monday morning to explain to him, and he was hot that he wasn't a top four seed, that he ended up being five, but he was even angrier that by being a number five seed, he was playing number 12. They were playing in Albuquerque, and they were playing Wyoming. You know, this is some of the nuances that the committee doesn't really take into consideration, is that, you know, you've got the better team, Gonzaga, having to go to altitude in Albuquerque and playing a team from altitude. And so he was doubly hot. And then, top it off, Wyoming beats Gonzaga that year. And he became even an angrier man after that. Uh-huh. But, you know, it means a lot to coaches, obviously, and it means a lot to fans. And, you know, as a committee member, fortunately, we were not as accessible as maybe committee members are today in terms of email addresses or phone numbers or whatever. But I remember another year I was on the committee with Chris Hill, who was the athletic director at Utah, and Mike Slive, who was the commissioner of the SEC. And the last three teams, and you'll remember this, the last three teams that got into the NCAA tournament, Utah State was just coming into the WAC. They got in. Air Force got in for their first time ever.
Yeah.
And then Mississippi State was a surprise last team in. And a national, you know, basketball writer, Doug Gottlieb, took Mike Slive, Chris Hill, and Carl Benson to task for showing preferred treatment, that Benson protected Utah State and Chris Hill protected Air Force and Mike Slive protected Mississippi State, and, you know, pretty much put us out there and threw us under the bus and accused us of protecting our own, which, again, it happens. And I'm still waiting for that apology from Doug Gottlieb.
Yeah, because you weren't covering the WAC. You weren't involved with the WAC, so you couldn't make that decision.
You know, and they also, you know, they always say that when you're, you know, if it's a team from your conference, you know, you're outside during the conversation and you don't have a vote. So
let me put it this way. So you've got your S curve and you've got the number one team in the country overall. And so the number four team is also number one seed. Does that mean that the number four team will be put in a bracket with the toughest, the weakest one seed will be put in a bracket with the toughest two seed? Is that how they do this?
It is. I mean, that's the idea. And again, people who break these things down to determine which is the hardest, you know, region or who got the toughest draw. Yeah. It, you know, and now in analytics, all the analytics people are even going probably deeper than the committee goes to, you know, to try to determine, you know, which region. And then you throw in, Mark, you throw in the betting lines now and the amount of data that they have in terms of defensive teams playing offensive teams. And my guess is that it's created, you know, so much more, you know, gambling interest that was already there in the old days. You know, it was the bracket challenges that was generating the, you know, that turned us all into, not all of us, because those of us that work in the business, we couldn't even play in a bracket challenge.
Except for Rick. Rick Neuheis, exactly. He got to do it. But, okay, so answer me this, because this is a question a lot of people have. The brackets come out, and there's always those really intriguing matchups. So one year, Louisville and Kentucky played each other, but something along those lines. I'm sitting here, I'm writing, fantasizing about what could happen as a Colorado State fan and alum, and saying, listen, if the University of Colorado, they're the fourth seed in the Pac-12 tournament, already beat Arizona once, they're on the outside looking in, according to all the bracketologists right now. They're not going to be in. But if they were to beat Oregon and Arizona and get to the final, and maybe win, they say they won the Pac-12 tournament and they got the stolen automatic bid. Would the committee look at this and say, a 10th seed Colorado and a 7th seed Colorado State might make for an intriguing first round matchup? Is there any consideration at all to given to those, that kind of situation where you might set up a really cool matchup, or is it all scientific?
It's all based on numbers. Now, again, as we each evaluate our own votes, and again, in my days, it was handwritten ballots. It's right now the electronic balloting.
Sure.
And, you know, you would have immediate votes, but and only one person, only one NCAA staff person would notice if somebody was trying to jockey. And if there was, there were times when a NCAA staff member, probably Hancock, would side up to somebody and show them their ballot and say, are you sure this is what you want to do? And, and sometimes they would say yes. And sometimes, you know, they would say, oh yeah, I made a mistake. I thought it was Iowa State versus Iowa or something like that. Yeah. But in terms of those, you know, those matchups, there really wasn't. The only time that I ever remember where the committee screwed up in the bracketing and in the seeding was that BYU was placed, you know, as a number seven seed. I'm not just throw out whatever number, but there were always these safeguards because BYU was one of those teams that could only play in the Thursday, Saturday,
right,
first round.
Right.
That fed then into, you know, the Friday or the Thursday, Saturday.
Right.
And this particular year, it slipped through and the brackets come out on Sunday night. And sure enough, BYU is on the side of the bracket that is playing Friday, Sunday. Yeah. Yeah. And so there had to be a, you know, mea culpa and Jim Liebengood, who was the athletic director at the University of Arizona at the time, was the committee member. And interesting enough, you know, he's a member of the church. He's LDS.
Wow.
And I, you know, I knew enough about BYU's history that I should have caught it, but neither one of us caught it. And, you know, the committee had, you know, had a little bit of egg on their face, but that's the only time that I can remember that there was ever any real, you know, real egregious error. And it wasn't intentional. It just fell through the cracks, but you know, there's a lot of, you know, when Bob Knight went from Indiana to Texas Tech, you know, everybody thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if Texas Tech played Indiana?
Yeah, exactly.
And you know,
they don't try to set those up.
And I was on the committee at the time, and I remember that there may have been an opportunity, but you know, and then again, some of the rules about not playing another conference member until you know the round of eight. You know, some of those now though that conferences are getting
It's unavoidable now.
You know, seven, eight, nine bids.
You can't do it anymore.
It is unavoidable. But I tell you what, it was what I will say, and Bill, you know, Bill was the kind of the mastermind along with Tom Jernstedt, and there was another longtime media guy by the name of Dave K. Wood, and then Jim Marchione. Those guys had the policies and procedures down so much and so rigid in terms of making sure that there were no mistakes, you know, except for that BYU time.
Right.
It was, you know, it was really a well-oiled machine that came into that.
Okay. So you get to Selection Sunday. How much work is really left to be done that day? How much of it is in pen instead of pencil? I mean, do the outcomes of conference tournaments on Saturday and Sunday matter that much, or are they pretty much in place with maybe some minor tweaks?
Yeah, sometimes, and in my 5 years, there was enough flexibility and enough options that we'd be able to kind of put it to bed early, regardless of what happened in that Big Ten game.
Or the Big 12,
which was, Big Ten, Big 12, that were those late games. But there were other times when it went right down to the wire and there were some close calls. You know, we always tried to, and I was fortunate enough that there was an Indianapolis to Denver flight Sunday evening at 6 o'clock or so that I was lucky enough to always get on. But there were several times when committee members would get stuck in Indianapolis, you know, on Sunday night. And again, you know, the work is done, but our jobs went then into the early week that we'd get back into our offices on Monday. And we were assigned one of the eight first and second round sites, being the primary committee member that would go to those sites. You know, we'd call each of the eight athletic directors and congratulate them. And again, kind of before social media, and, you know, we had to make sure they got their packets of information that were been hard copies and make that contact. And then if we were assigned a Thursday site, you know, we would leave on Tuesday and, you know, get to Salt Lake City or Denver or Albuquerque to prepare with the university that was on site. And probably one of my not necessarily a fond memory, but a memory in 2003 or four with the here we are coming up to a snowstorm here in Denver this week. The snowstorm of March 18th or 19th.
2003.
I was
CSU and Duke in Utah that year, I remember.
Yeah. And I was originally scheduled to go to Spokane until Tulsa was assigned to Spokane, and they had these last minute that because Tulsa was in the WAC, I got shifted to Salt Lake City. I went to DIA on that Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday afternoon, and actually on the plane that it was the last plane that didn't get out, the plane for Spokane that I would have been on to get to Tulsa went, and I ended up being on that plane that the Vermont team was first time that Tom Brennan had his Vermont team, and they got stuck in Denver. I made it home that night and sat it out and ended up being able to drive to Colorado Springs and got on a charter plane with the Vermont team that, wow, that got to Salt Lake City late, had to play that 10 o'clock morning game. And, you know, when I look at NCAA decisions and how people are so critical, you know, here, Vermont, they've got to travel two time zones to Salt Lake City. It's their first time in the tournament. They're playing a number one seed. I think they were playing Arizona, and they didn't get into Salt Lake City. And I was with them, so I knew when they got to the hotel. You know, they got to their hotel about midnight, and they had the first game on Thursday morning. And I was, you know, involved in the decision making, but I got the word from the NCAA. But Lute Olson, the gentleman that he was at the University of Arizona, he agreed to take a later game. And and there were other coaches who were willing to kind of give Vermont a little bit of a break, a little break. And the NCAA said, no, we can't, you know, we can't adjust the games because we need to protect the integrity going forward. And I sure understood that. And Tom Brennan was a perfect gentleman. And I still, when I hear him on various national radio shows today, to hear him talk about that first trip cross country and getting stuck, in Spokane and then going to Salt Lake City.
Hey, Carl,
a lot of good memories.
We're going to wrap it up real quick, but I got to ask you, did you enjoy that time? Was it more work than it was worth, or was it really a really cool thing to do?
It was cool. And, one of the benefits, committee members, kids get to be ball kids at Final Fours. And my daughter, Jessica, was a ball girl at the 2004, 5, and 6 Final Fours. Mm-hmm. And when people ask me what my fondest memory it was standing on the court on Monday night with Jessica when, One Shining Moment was played.
Ah, yes.
So she and I had that as one of our fondest memories. So a lot of fun, a lot of work. Probably could have, I told you early on that I did the 5-year stint. I was ready after 4 to probably call it quits.
It's a lot of work and people don't understand that, but I know you guys put in a ton of work. Guys are doing it right now, right as we speak, are doing a ton of work getting ready for this and to everyone's benefit. Hey, Carl, before I let you go here, got a thumbs up and thumbs down this week?
Well, right now I'm going to give a thumbs up to the committee because they haven't made any controversial.
Haven't screwed anything up yet. Yeah.
Screwed anything up yet. And probably my thumbs down will go to, the fans in the stands last night that kind of ruined one of those shining moments that Bryant College on the verge of going to their first NCAA tournament, that the fans in that arena kind of went out of control. And unfortunately here, March Madness is emotional, but there certainly needs to be safeguards to keep it from being embarrassing.
We'll be watching this weekend as the tournament brackets are unveiled, the conference tournament's finalized. And next week we'll start talking about the matchups and what's involved and who, I guess, we'll have you fill out your bracket and you tell us who's going to win it. How's that next week?
Sounds good.
All right, there he goes. Carl Benson, former commissioner of the WAC, the commish here on Knutson and the Commish, breaking down what it's like to be on the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee. Carl, take care of yourself. We'll talk to you next week and welcome everybody back to hear more about March Madness. Thanks.